Unit 9, A Time of Upheaval, 1954 to 1980. Why It Matters. From a presidential assassination to massive governmental programs, from the Vietnam War to the Civil Rights Movement, the post-World War II decades immensely affected the lives of Americans. The nation struggled to put its social and political ideals into practice while fighting military wars overseas and social wars at home. Understanding how these events unfolded provides a window to the world you live in today. Chapter 28, The New Frontier and the Great Society, 1961 to 1968. Why It Matters. President John F. Kennedy urged Americans to work for progress and to stand firm against the Soviets. Cold War tensions and the threat of nuclear war peaked during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy's assassination changed the nation's mood, but President Lyndon Johnson embraced ambitious goals, including working toward the passage of major civil rights legislation and eradicating poverty. The impact today. Initiatives introduced in this era remain a part of American society. Medicaid and Medicare legislation provides major health benefits for elderly and low-income people. The Head Start program provides early educational opportunities for disadvantaged children. Section 1, The New Frontier, An American Story. On September 26, 1960, at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, streets all across the United States grew strangely still. An estimated 75 million people sat indoors, focused on their television sets, where they saw two men standing behind lecterns. One was John F. Kennedy, and the other was Richard M. Nixon. For the first time, thanks to the wonders of television, two presidential candidates were coming right into the nation's living rooms to debate. Americans were enthralled. You hear each man directly, observed one. There's nothing between you and what he says, added another. You can see which man gets rattled easily. The man who seemed to get rattled easily was Nixon. Kennedy, the Democratic nominee, looked healthy, strong, and confident. Nixon, the Republican's choice, came across as tired and frazzled. He appeared ill, one viewer commented. In fact, Nixon had been ill recently. Kennedy had a glowing tan, while Nixon's face was pale and drawn, shadowed by the stubble of a beard. As one observer noted, Nixon's eyes darted around. Perspiration was clearly noticeable on his chin, and with the tight shots, these things were more obvious. Adapted from The Great Debate. The Election of 1960. The television debates of the 1960 presidential election had enormous impact. Following the debate, the media focused more strongly on the appearance of the candidates. Suddenly, the whole country seemed to have become experts on makeup and television lighting. One Republican leader even wondered if the Democrats had supplied Nixon's makeup. With that debate, the era of television politics had begun. Though television had been used in campaigns as early as 1948, it was not until the 1960 election that a large majority of voters used the medium as a voting tool. The nation itself seemed on the brink of a new age. Having lived through a decade of unprecedented prosperity and the onset of the Cold War and the Atomic Age, Americans looked to the future with excitement and anxiety. Both candidates share the desire to lead the nation through the challenges of a new decade, but they differed in many ways. Kennedy, a Catholic, came from a wealthy and influential Massachusetts family. Nixon, a Quaker, was a Californian from a financially struggling family. Kennedy seemed outgoing and relaxed, while Nixon struck many as formal and even stiff in manner. A new kind of campaign. Compared to earlier campaigns, the 1960 presidential race made new use of television, with both major parties spending substantial amounts of money on television ads. The Democrats spent over $6 million in television and radio spots, while the Republicans spent more than $7.5 million. Not everyone was happy with this new emphasis on image. Television news commentator Eric Severide complained that the candidates had become packaged products, and he stated that the processed politician has finally arrived. The main issues. The campaign centered on the economy and the Cold War. Although the candidates presented different styles, they differed little on these two issues. Both promised to boost the economy, and both portrayed themselves as cold warriors, determined to stop the forces of communism. Kennedy argued that the nation faced serious threats from the Soviets. In Cuba, Fidel Castro was allying himself with the Soviet Union. At home, many people lived in fear of a Soviet nuclear attack. Kennedy voiced his concern about a suspected missile gap in which the United States lagged behind the Soviets in weaponry. Decades later, Americans learned that, in fact, the only area where the Soviet Union was briefly ahead was in rocketry. The nation, Kennedy argued, had grown complacent and aimless. It is time to get this country moving again. Nixon countered that the United States was on the right track under the current administration. "I'm tired of hearing our opponents downgrade the United States," the vice president said. Nixon also warned that the Democrats' fiscal policies would boost inflation and that only he had the necessary foreign policy experience to guide the nation. Kennedy came under scrutiny about his religion. The United States had never had a Catholic president, and many Protestants had concerns about Kennedy. Kennedy decided to confront the issue openly in a speech. "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute," he said, "where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act." The four televised debates strongly influenced the outcome of the election, one of the closest in American history. Kennedy won the popular vote by 118,000 out of 68 million votes cast, and the Electoral College by 303 votes to 219. In several states, only a few thousand votes could have swung the Electoral College numbers the other way. Reading check. Identifying. What were two main issues of the 1960 presidential election? The Kennedy mystique. Despite his narrow victory, John F. Kennedy, commonly referred to as JFK, captured the imagination of the American public as few presidents before him had. During the campaign, many had been taken with Kennedy's youth and optimism. The new president strongly reinforced this impression when he gave his inaugural address. Inauguration Day, January 20, 1961, was crisp and cold in Washington, D.C. At the site of the ceremony, a crowd gathered, wrapped in coats and blankets. As Kennedy rose to take the oath of office, he wore neither a coat nor a hat. During his speech, the new president declared, "The torch has been passed to a new generation," and he called on his fellow citizens to take a more active role in making the United States a better place. "My fellow Americans," he exclaimed, "ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." Kennedy, his wife Jacqueline, and their children Caroline and John, and their large extended family, seemed to have been created for media coverage. Reporters followed the family everywhere. Kennedy himself was a master of the media, particularly television. He was the first to broadcast his press conferences live on television. The Kennedy charisma inspired many of his staff members. His press secretary, Pierre Salinger, put this feeling into words. "None of us will ever have a better job as long as we live. The big plus, the fringe benefit that made it all worthwhile, was JFK himself. Our faith in him and in what he was trying to do was absolute, and he could impart to our work together a sense of challenge and adventure, a feeling that he was moving, and the world with him, toward a better time." Quoted in With Kennedy. Reading check. Summarizing. In what ways did John F. Kennedy inspire the nation? Success and setback on the domestic front. Not everyone in the nation fell for the Kennedy mystique. His high culture, elite Northeast upbringing, and Catholicism irritated some Americans. Congress also was less than taken with the new president. Upon entering office, President Kennedy set out to implement a legislative agenda, which became known as the New Frontier. He hoped to increase aid to education, provide health insurance to the elderly, create a Department of Urban Affairs, and help migrant workers. he would soon find that transforming lofty ideals into real legislation was no easy task on Capitol Hill. Kennedy's struggles with Congress. Although the Democratic Party enjoyed large majorities in both houses of Congress, Kennedy was unable to push through many of his domestic programs. Kennedy had trailed Nixon in many Democratic districts and had not helped many Democrats get elected. Those who did win, therefore, did not feel they owed him anything. As one Democrat in Congress told U.S. News & World Report, a good many congressional representatives were elected in 1960 in spite of his presence on the ticket, rather than because his name was there. As a result, legislators found it easy to follow their own interests rather than those of the president. In addition, Republicans, as well as conservative Southern Democrats, who were responsible for holding the Democratic majority in Congress, viewed the new frontier as too big and too costly. Senator Everett Dirksen, Republican minority leader from Illinois, claimed that Kennedy's efforts to increase the power and reach of the federal government would push the nation down an ominous path. In the end, Congress defeated a number of JFK's proposals, including health insurance for the elderly, a Department of Urban Affairs, and federal aid to education. The president often resisted calls to push harder for his agenda. He decided not to fight every battle on Capitol Hill and preferred to reserve his bargaining power for issues that were both truly important and winnable. Economics. Strengthening the economy. Kennedy did achieve some victories in Congress, particularly in his efforts to improve the nation's economy. The American economy, which had soared through much of the 1950s, had slowed by the end of the decade. From 1960 to 1961, the growth rate of the gross national product was only 2%, while the unemployment rate hovered near 7% of the workforce, the second highest figure since World War II. In an effort to increase growth and create more jobs, Kennedy advocated the New Deal strategy of deficit spending, first implemented during Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. The new president convinced Congress to invest more funds in defense and in space exploration. Such spending did indeed create more jobs and stimulate economic growth. Reluctant to rely too heavily on deficit spending, which tends to cause inflation, Kennedy also sought to boost the economy by increasing business production and efficiency. In addition, his administration asked businesses to hold down prices and labor leaders to hold down pay increases. Prodded by Secretary of Labor Arthur Goldberg, labor unions in the steel industry agreed to reduce their demands for higher wages. In 1962, however, several steel companies raised prices sharply. The president threatened to have the Department of Defense buy cheaper steel from foreign companies and instructed the Justice Department to investigate whether the steel industry was guilty of price fixing. In response to Kennedy's tactics, the steel companies backed down and cut their prices. To achieve this victory, however, the president had strained his relations with the nation's business community. In an effort to get the economy moving, Kennedy also adopted supply-side ideas and pushed for a cut in tax rates. When opponents argued that a tax cut would only help the wealthy, Kennedy asserted that lower taxes meant businesses would have more money to expand, which would create new jobs and benefit everybody. A rising tide lifts all boats, Kennedy explained, as a way to illustrate how tax cuts would stimulate the economy and help all Americans. Kennedy also convinced Congress to increase the minimum hourly wage to $1.25. In addition, he provided more than $400 million in aid to distressed areas under the Area Redevelopment Act. Meanwhile, the administration's Housing Act created an extensive home building and slum clearance program, as well as thousands of construction jobs. Women's rights. Kennedy also helped women make strides during the 1960s. Although Kennedy never appointed a woman to his cabinet, a number of women worked in prominent positions in his administration, including Esther Peterson, Assistant Secretary of Labor and Director of the Women's Bureau of the Department of Labor. Kennedy advanced women's rights in other ways as well. In 1961, he created the Presidential Commission on the Status of Women. The commission called for federal action against gender discrimination and affirmed the right of women to equally paid employment. Kennedy responded by issuing an executive order ending gender discrimination in the federal civil service, and in 1963, he signed the Equal Pay Act for women. The commission also sparked the creation of similar groups on the state level and inspired many women to work together to further their interests. Reading check. Evaluating. Why did Kennedy have difficulty getting his New Frontier legislation passed? Warren Court reforms. During the Kennedy years, the Supreme Court also took an active role in social issues. In 1953, President Eisenhower had nominated Earl Warren, the popular Republican governor of California, to become Chief Justice of the United States. More so than previous courts, the Warren Court took an activist stance, helping to shape national policy by taking a forceful stand on a number of key issues of the day. Government. One man, one vote. One of the Warren Court's most notable decisions had a powerful impact on who would hold political power in the United States. This decision concerned reapportionment, or the way in which states draw up political districts based on changes in population. By 1960, many more Americans resided in cities and suburbs than in rural areas, yet many states had failed to restructure their electoral districts to reflect that change. In Tennessee, for example, a rural country with only 2,340 voters had one representative in the state assembly, while an urban county with 133 times more voters had only seven. The vote of a city dweller counted for less than the vote of a rural resident. Some Tennessee voters took the matter to court. The Baker versus Carr case reached the Supreme Court after a federal court ruled that the issue should be solved by legislation. The 14th Amendment specifically gives Congress authority to enforce voting rights. In 1962, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal courts did have jurisdiction and sent the matter back to the lower courts. 2 years later, in June 1964, the Supreme Court ruled in Reynolds v. Sims that the current apportionment system in most states was indeed unconstitutional. In a decision that helped to promote the principle of one man, one vote, the Warren Court required state legislatures to reapportion electoral districts so that all citizens' votes would have equal weight. The court's decision was a momentous one, for it shifted political power throughout the country from rural and often conservative areas to urban areas where more liberal voters resided. The court's decision also boosted the political power of African Americans and Hispanics, who typically lived in cities. Extending due process. In a series of historic rulings in the 1960s, the U.S. Supreme Court began to use the 14th Amendment to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. Originally, the Bill of Rights applied only to the federal government. Many states had their own Bill of Rights, but some federal rights did not exist at the state level. The 14th Amendment specifically stated that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Due process means that the law may not treat individuals unfairly, arbitrarily, or unreasonably, and that courts must follow proper procedures and rules when trying cases. Due process ensures that all people are treated the same by the court system. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court ruled in several cases that upholding due process meant applying the federal Bill of Rights to the states. In 1961, the Supreme Court ruled in Mapp v. Ohio that state courts could not consider evidence obtained in violation of the federal Constitution. In Gideon v. Wainwright, 1963, the court ruled that a defendant in a state court had the right to a lawyer, regardless of his or her ability to pay. The following year, in Escobedo v. Illinois, the justices ruled that a suspect must be allowed access to a lawyer and must be informed of his or her right to remain silent before being questioned by the police. Miranda v. Arizona, 1966, went even further, requiring that authorities immediately give suspects a fourfold warning. The warning consisted of informing suspects that they have the right to remain silent, that anything they say can and will be used against them in court, that they have a right to a lawyer while being questioned, and that if they cannot afford a lawyer, the court will appoint one for them. Today, these warnings are known as the Miranda Rights. Many citizens and police departments and even some of the Supreme Court justices accused the Warren Court of favoring criminals. Others cheered the decisions, seeing them as promoting the rights of all citizens, even the less privileged. Prayer and privacy. The Supreme Court also handed down decisions that reaffirmed the separation of church and state. The court applied the First Amendment to the states in Engle v. Vitale, 1962. In this ruling, the court decided that states could not compose official prayers and require those prayers to be recited in state public schools. The following year, in Abingdon School District v. Shemp, it ruled against daily Bible readings in public schools. Weighing in on another controversial issue, the court ruled in Griswold v. Connecticut, 1965, that prohibiting the sale and use of birth control devices violated citizens' constitutional right to privacy. As with most rulings of the Warren Court, these decisions delighted some and deeply disturbed others. What most people did agree upon, however, was the court's pivotal role in shaping national policy. The Warren Court, wrote New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, has brought about more social change than most Congresses and most presidents. From the political arena to the legal system to people's everyday lives, the Warren Court indeed left its imprint on the nation. Meanwhile, away from the domestic arena, President Kennedy worked to make his mark on the country's foreign affairs during a time of rising Cold War tensions. Reading check. Examining. What was the significance of the Warren Court's one man, one vote ruling?